Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Charles Spence. How are you, Charles?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent. We're going to crack on and continue talking about wine pricing today. You did some work looking at pricing of wine, and there was some interesting concepts in there. One was about setting a It was a preconditioning people to a particular price point, so, and then saying, well, this wine's worth £50, what would you pay for this wine? They'd taste it and they'd say it's worth this much, but if you told them it was worth £10 and let them taste it, they'd come up with, on average, a lower price point, yep. Even though what they're supposed to be doing is tasting the wine and judging the wine without considering the initial price point. Do you want to just talk a wee bit about that?
Because that would be the concept of kind of end anchoring. Whatever sort of judgments we're making about life and insurance and how much to invest and how much to pay off on our credit card, if you start with a number, a value, even if it's a random value, like from a roulette wheel, you cannot stop yourself from anchoring your final judgment of whatever it is you're thinking about to that starting value. Hence, the trick for the marketeer, and this is used very effectively in many contexts now, if you want people to think that something is worth more, then give them a high-end anchor. So if you say it's a £50 wine, but for today only, half price.
Yep.
Then you say, I don't really believe it's £50 wine. They can't. Where's the profit in that? I think it must be worth 35. The end value you come up with, even though you know the 50 value is wrong, will be higher than if I'd said, you know, it's really only £10 because of its rarity value. It's going to cost more. So we cannot overcome the anchor points we start with. And there's a real challenge there, I guess, in the marketing to think about how do you maintain also the kind of perception of value when you start discounting 2-for-1, 3-for-2s. What sort of psychological and neuroscience tricks are there to help a company, no matter what it is that they're selling, keep in the consumer's mind, the drinker's mind, a perception this is a high-cost product,
yeah,
but for a temporal, at least, it's discounted.
You see that in the supermarkets. Like, everybody knows that when you get a wine that's half-priced, there was a big hoo-ha last a month ago about it, where what the supermarket pricing were doing, and they were jamming it up to 10 quid, setting a price for the minimum requirement, then dropping it to half price. It spends all its time at half price, then it goes back up to reset the price again and drop. And people still think they're getting a bargain, even though all the wine sold at 5 quid, so the wine's got to be worth 5 quid. You know, I've seen these 5 quid Pinot Grigios that were, well, supposedly £10. They're never 10 quid. They're always £5 Pinot Grigios.
Yeah.
But most people just cannot help themselves. They think they're getting a bargain, even though they're not.
None of us can help ourselves, we're psychologists as much as anybody else. But that said, I mean, what comes out of our review of all the blind taste test studies that have been published and all of our own work is that in kind of blind tasting, people cannot tell the price, expert, social drinker alike. But as soon as you know the price, it tastes better, which sounds kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah.
But then it could be psychologically, and that's all we have to go on about how a wine tastes. If you think it costs £10, if you believe that the kind of the story, the marketing hype, then it will actually taste maybe not like a £10 wine, but tastes significantly better than a wine you thought only cost £5. So that kind of psychological impact of perceived price is a very powerful thing and is a large part of what differentiates one wine from another. And most of the time, I guess we do know the price, or we can feel the weight of the bottle, or see the vintage, or we have the kind of the brand from the big vineyards that give us that kind of information that this, or the box that says this is a kind of expensive wine. Maybe I can't say exactly how much, but I'm thinking it's expensive, and that will then set my subsequent experience. Maybe it acts as an anchor point again. If I think it's an expensive wine, then I'll be drawn towards those attributes in the wine that seem to kind of confirm my expectation.
And do you think, because I consider myself a bit of a wine expert, I've got ways that I value wines, you know, that are metrics. I can taste a wine, go through a set of metrics and come up with a price point. And usually I'm pretty right, but that's not to do necessarily with how I enjoy the wine, but looking at certain factors in the wine and understanding things about how the wine's made and things like that, then I can price a wine.
So I guess this all gets very philosophical at some point. There's sort of single blind and double blind taste tests. So if you were to come around to the next blind tasting that we do, which you're invited, then maybe we'll tell you absolutely nothing about the wines at all.
Yeah.
There may be whites and reds from this country or that. So you have absolutely nothing to go on. And then, almost in a way, perhaps you cannot judge, even to your own metrics, maybe the quality of the wine as being typical of that region if you're not sure it is. of that region.
Mm-hmm.
So, but maybe if it's in a vertical tasting or something, and you know something, the vineyard, but not the year, then you've kind of narrowed down your choice. And when I speak to some of Robert Parker's top deputies, they'll sort of confess in a complete blind tasting, we're hopeless. It's only in this restricted range when we know the country or the region that those judgments that we make that are partly what we value in a wine, how typical it is, and how it emphasises the kind of key characteristics of that region, of that grape, those things we can't necessarily pick up on, totally blind. So you might say, well, is there any use in doing a completely blind wine test? Because we never drink wine like that. Maybe not. But then that is the thing that's used in many of the wine shows. So I think there's a real sort of tension here between what's the right thing to do. And people often point to, well, there is this or that expert, or we saw Oz Clark do it, you know, 15 years ago on TV, picked a mixed bottle of 82 and 83, whatever it was. And we have tested some sommeliers who do seem to do quite well, but it can be very hard to get a grouping of the true experts. So we can test those who are in wine societies, those who write the books about. We've got a paper coming out in 2 weeks' time where we took the people who write the champagne books. They're experts of sorts. Can they tell the price blind? Nope. Can they even tell the grape mix? Nope. Do they write as if they could? Yes. If they see the wine, can they do it? I'm sure that your expectations then kind of come to fill in. But there may be just that they couldn't do it blind. Perhaps that's neither here nor there. And that maybe they aren't really the true experts. We want the people in kind of the cellars who are doing the mixing. Maybe they're the ones who really can taste. But can we get a room full of those who actually make the wine to test them? It's very, very difficult.
Yeah,
sometimes
yeah.
They won't want to be tested. Other times they're in such different places, it's hard to get them together. And perhaps they could do things, but no one's ever been able to get them together at a time to do a proper wine tasting to see.
Okay, no, that's quite good. Just one other thing before we close up on this. You mentioned in one of the studies where people put people into an MRI scanner,
yep,
and gave them different wines, and you actually looked at how the brain... Mm-hmm. responded to people's perceptions, mm-hmm, not so much on the taste, but on their perceptions of the price, yep, on the wine. So people actually do have a chemical, biological response to wine in terms of the way they perceive the wine. So when they're enjoying a wine more, they actually are physically enjoying it more, even if it's not because of the wine they're drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to tell us about that?
So there have been a few studies now of wine tasting in the brain scanner, trying to see which parts of the brain light up when you're tasting a wine. Does it depend on the price that you've been told the wine cost? Or does it depend on your degree of expertise? Do wine experts recruit more of their brain and hence maybe that's why they can tell more, or do they recruit less because they're more expert? So lots of studies going on. I guess one has to be aware that when you're doing the wine tasting in the scanner, you're lying flat on your back with a tube in your mouth, being given little squirts of wine. You have to keep your head completely still. So it's not like the real savouring of a glass of wine. Nevertheless, you can tell some things. And in one of the classic studies done over at in California by Hilke Plassmans, at kind of the marketing department there, she took people, put them in the scanner, gave them squirts of wine, and she had something like $5, $10, and $45 wine that she could tell them. Before each squirt, a price would come up on the screen saying this wine cost $10, $45, or $90. And then she looked at the activity and the parts of the brain that code for reward and pleasure. And in particular, the bit of the brain just between the eyes and slightly back a little bit, that's called the OFC, or the orbitofrontal cortex. And that's the one that all the marketeers are interested in. That's one that when you're really enjoying something, you'll see more blood flowing there. And she was able to see that the price she had told the people in the scanner that the wine cost determined how much activity she saw in the pleasure center of the brain,
mm-hmm,
over and above the actual price differences. So there, the pleasure kind of physiologically recorded in the brain, as it were, was being determined by the perceived price rather than the sensory qualities of the wine itself.
And that makes sense as well, because once you start paying silly amounts for wine, and I have a view, rightly or wrongly, that once you get over about 25 quid,
mm-hmm,
it's very hard to tell the difference, mm-hmm, from a qualitative point of view. I can tell the difference between a 20 quid bottle of wine and a 5 quid bottle of wine using metrics that I think I can,
yep,
do reliably.
We'll bring you in one of these days.
Yeah, bring me in. I'm up for that. I'm always up for being tested. But once you get over 25 quid, it could be 25 quid or it could be £3,000. You don't know. But you mentioned in a study where people were bidding crazy prices for a bottle of wine. And it's almost guaranteed that the more they bid, the more they're going to enjoy the wine if they drink it. So there's almost like a, if I bid more, I'm going to get more pleasure out of it.
And you will, and I bet the bits of the brain that care about code and pleasure will light up more. So it is this kind of counterintuitive thing. In the blind taste test, you cannot tell the difference. You can't pick the price of what you're drinking. But as soon as you know that price, even if it's an arbitrary, silly number, the price you pay or somebody paid will in large part determine the pleasure you experience.
You mentioned that in some studies it's shown that men, if you're taking wine to a dinner party,
yep.
You bought your wine at the shop, you're taking it to the dinner party, and that you should always tell people the price of the wine, irrespective of the price.
However you do it, and so it can be subtly or it can be obviously.
Yeah, and it doesn't matter if it's a cheap bottle or expensive wine. People will enjoy it more if they know the price, as opposed to, I spent £2 on this bottle of turpentine. That's still better than just giving them the bottle of turpentine, so to speak. What's going on there?
I mean, I guess there's kind of the dinner party dilemma, I suppose it's caused. Of you're going to take a bottle of wine to a friend's house for dinner. You don't want to seem cheap. You want them to think that you've spent lots of money on this wine. How do you convey that? It's a good thing to convey because it will make wine taste better, as we've seen. But how do you do it? Well, then it could be by leaving the label on the bottle. It could be by, you see, many of the wines in the store coming in a box, wooden box. That's, again, conveying this notion of an expensive product. Or it could be through the certain sort of chateau.
Or you could just say, themselves. Look, I spent £20 on you.
Or feel the weight. If you've got a particularly heavy bottle, that'll work.
Yeah,
feel the quality.
But why do people enjoy the wine, even if it's a cheap bottle of wine? Why will they enjoy it more if they know the price?
Because I think that's a completely end anchoring. So if you tell them that the price, and it happens to be a high price, then that sets their either expecting good. It should taste like a whatever price wine it is,
and then
then their actual experience will tend to be, unless it's hugely divergent. I say this cost £100, say it tastes like a £5 bottle. If there's a huge discrepancy, maybe you'll get a rebound and say, it's nothing like what I expected, I really don't like it. But within a fairly broad range of values, you'll find that your experience, if it's not too different from the price you expected or were told, will drift towards that price through this end anchoring mechanism and through the fact that people cannot tell in the blind taste tests the difference in price.
What about if you give them a cheap bottle of wine? Because you said it seemed to say that even if it was cheap, they would still enjoy it more if they knew it was a £5 bottle of wine.
Well, that could be. Maybe it might be that you... if you know that, then you can be rest assured that whatever you say about the wine is going to be complimentary almost.
Okay, and one of the studies also pointed out that men are less affected by this than women. Is that because men are more analytical or
just better? I don't know.
Yeah, you don't know.
I suppose they're hard to, in a way, tease apart sort of how much prior experience in the buying or the drinking process that the men and women might have. That might feed into that, how impressed they are by, or not, by the price.
Okay. All right then, Charles, I think we're going to wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And thanks very much, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.
Okay, thank you.
Cheers, bud.